Hi, it's been a while. Hello, this is the Greg Kelly Podcast. Forgive me, but I've had a few things to take care of in life, like having another child and moving from one location to another. Yes, moved houses. We move from one to another, and, you know, a lot goes into that. And a child on the scene, she's, what, 2 weeks old now, and her big sister, Annalise, is getting used to her. Not a whole heck of a lot of interest from her in the newest family member, but that's okay. At least there isn't resentment and hostility, which, quite frankly, I anticipated. But no, it's a beautiful thing, and we're very, very pleased. In the meantime, today I'm happy to be speaking with Brent Canfield. He's a United States Marine from Ohio who is now the CEO of his own security company. It's called Smart Digital. He's got this really cool thing. It's called a Sentry Pod. It's basically a remote camera that you can access anywhere throughout the world within 30 seconds, and you can just put them up very, very easily. It really could revolutionize security. And also, he specializes in applying a lot of the things he learned in the Marine Corps to his civilian mission of providing enhanced security for businesses and industry. And I really like him. He's done a lot with his life. The guy has lived to the max pretty much since the very, very beginning. Marine Corps was very, very important to him, had a big impact on his life. He fought in war and in Iraq and also Afghanistan. This guy is battle hardened and smart. And oh, by the way, he's a man of faith, deep faith. Everything about him I find, quite frankly, pretty inspiring. And I think you will like listening to him very much. Brent Canfield, an American hero who's really living the American dream. In the meantime, you know, since the American Revolution, drinking coffee has been declared at times an act of patriotism. Especially during these times, we can't forget what makes us uniquely American. Hard work, self-determination, individual liberty. Freedom doesn't brew itself. And that's why I drink D'Espresso Liber. Founded by a Green Beret almost a decade ago who developed a dedication to crafting outstanding brews after multiple deployments, D'Espresso Liber coffee is 100% Arabica coffee, sourced from the finest coffee farms from around the world and is roasted fresh in-house once they receive your order. The D'Espresso Liber experience starts from the moment you open the package. The aroma is almost as good as the flavor. Not kidding here. I can smell the coffee through the packaging even before I open the bag. And although I'm no coffee expert, I can tell you D'Espresso Liber coffee is out of this world. It's tasty, full-bodied, smooth. It gives me a delicious jumpstart to my day, rich in flavor and American values. D'Espresso Liber coffee encourages all of us to sit down together and unite with fellow patriots to celebrate our God-given rights. Just visit DiEspressoLiber.com. That's D'Espresso, D-E-E-S-P-R-E-S-S-O, Liber, L-I-B-E-R.com, D'EspressoLiber, L-I-B-E-R.com. Make your order today. And remember, freedom does not brew itself. And now our conversation with the CEO of Smart Digital, Brent Canfield. How's life, by the way, overall? How you feeling?
Life is good. Yeah, I'm feeling really good.
What is your job title right now? You're the CEO.
Yeah, I'm the CEO of Smart Digital, and Smart Digital is a security company.
By the way, Smart Digital is a great name, and I'm surprised like somebody didn't take it in 1978 or something like that. Was it there for the taking? Was anybody else? Did you have to compete for it?
You know, it really wasn't. When I was doing my name search, I looked at different things, and I did not want to be tactical, which I know you've got a Marine Corps background as well. But I didn't want to be tactical because I didn't want to just that be my only core focus. So I wanted to be very intelligent, very intuitive, and I wanted my security company to be, very intuitive and very intelligent. So that's why I decided the Smart Digital name.
Yeah, it's smart. You wanted to get away from like a military themed, tactical, Black Guard security or something like that. Is that what you were thinking? Just so you'd be seen as more, I guess, multifaceted.
Correct, exactly. Yeah, so we're not a guard company, we're a technical company. So I kind of converted from being tactical to technical, still protecting people.
How many people are in your company?
We have 8 employees and we're adding 2 more in the near future. In the next 3 to 4 weeks, we'll be adding a couple more. So we'll have 10 employees.
How long has the company existed?
8 years. 2013, I formed my company.
Now, there are a lot of great things in owning your own business and a lot of limitations as well. Just do me a favor. Give me what is the number one advantage to doing it the way you did it, starting your own company, being the boss, the number one thing you like most about it.
What I liked the most is the hard lessons that I've learned from bootstrapping my business and the tenacity that's required in being a business owner. I would say that I tell people, the most people that ask me, I would probably compare it very much to combat, because it's kind of the same thing, only you're exchanging the ammunition for money. And if you run out of money or ammunition, you're dead.
Huh. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. What about, okay, what's the worst part of all this? I mean, when you're in charge, you're in charge. That's great, but it's also a pain in the neck at times.
Yeah. I would say that the worst part of business is it's just like in the Marine Corps. You only move as fast as your slowest man. And in business, you only move as fast as the challenges and obstacles, that are in front of you.
And also, it's like, look, obviously, I would imagine you're the hardest working guy there, right?
Sure.
And you see another side to people. Like, I'm sure you have a great team, but when you're hiring or you're firing, it's different from, I mean, most people work for somebody else. Can you
Right.
explain, like, what's the difference between working for somebody else and working for yourself, or working for, with a vision that you came up with that you're trying to execute?
Well, that's a great question, Greg. And I think a lot of it has to do with, at the end of the day, I'm responsible for all the decisions made. When you're working for someone else, you're basically on. You're on the bandwagon of someone else's ideas, someone else's dreams, someone else's vision, someone else's decisions. And when you own your own business, you're responsible for all the decisions that are made. And if there is a failure, it's probably a result of a decision you made. And if there's success, it's a result of a decision you made. So it all, the end all be all for a business owner is you're making those decisions.
So Smart Digital, in a nutshell, what does it do? What do you guys do?
So Smart Digital is a security company that focuses on all aspects and faucets of security systems, which are alarm systems, fire alarm systems, surveillance systems, which are cameras, access control systems, which are basically you creating a way to allow users to have access to a zone, and also access gates. We've been doing access gates now for a little better than a year, and that's been a new venture of ours, but a very lucrative venture.
Who's your typical customer? Who's your target customer? Or is it too broad to classify, your typical customer?
Yeah, so our typical customer, Greg, are commercial customers, manufacturing facilities, industrial customers. We really don't do a lot with residential customers. I mean, to be honest, we're a security company, but we don't do a lot of residential alarm systems because it's a very, very low margin type business. And quite frankly, I decided a long time ago, I'm not a door knocker. So I don't go door to door knocking on people's doors. It's just not who I am, because I also wouldn't expect my team to be able to do that. So we focus on commercial industrial type customers.
So, like, let's say I had a factory, a mid-sized factory, we're making tables in upstate New York, and we're in a town that's adjacent to a high-crime area. Just give me a sense, if you could. I mean, am I the type of customer that would do business with Smart Digital? What would you guys do for a mid-sized, warehouse manufacturing plant?
So our philosophy is to secure the perimeter. Again, just like I use all my training in the Marine Corps to parlay into my business, and it's very effective. And so what we try to do for the customers, we try to secure the perimeter. We're going to do that by having, an alarm system that can detect when a door opens and closes, a camera system that can see the activity, and access control to control the internal zones, if you will, or rooms of that facility.
And, like, who would monitor it? Is it monitored through artificial intelligence, or do you need people monitoring it? How does it work?
Both. We combine AI with people. And I'll talk a little bit about that, with the new paradigm of our CenturyPods product. But we've combined human intelligence with central station live monitors, and it's very effective, and it's very... It's just very effective, and it allows us to receive a notification from a device that sends notification based on basic AI, and then we have the human element monitor that.
So how much, if I am a business owner and I'm making this stuff and I got valuable equipment, are businesses who approach you, are they also concerned? I assume they've got to be about... not only outsiders, securing that perimeter, but insiders potentially ripping them off, doing who knows what. If you're a business owner, you got to be concerned about that. And you guys obviously can be of use in that regard, right?
Absolutely. Definitely. Most of the time they're just trying to protect people and assets. In some cases, the occurrence happens from within.
So how old are you, by the way, may I ask?
I am 47.
Where were you born?
Born in Worcester, Ohio.
And your parents, what did they do? Who are they?
So my dad was a toolmaker his whole life. I just lost my dad a couple of years ago, 2019. I lost my dad, and my mom lives somewhere down in Kentucky.
And you have brothers and sisters?
I do. I have a brother and I have two sisters. My oldest sister lives in Michigan. My brother and I are neighbors, and my sister lives within a mile. My youngest sister lives within a mile of us. So we're all, three of us are pretty close.
What was it like, growing up? What, tell me a little bit about your childhood, and earliest memories, if you don't mind.
Yeah, so my childhood was a little bit different than most people because I had a dad. My mom and dad divorced back when I was a kid in 81, so I was just a youngster then. And my dad took on the father, and the mother role because my mom was the type that just didn't want to stick around. So she basically left my dad with three kids. And so my dad basically... put his life up on a shelf and, took care of three kids. So he was, my dad was a very demanding, very critical type person because, we always said he was a type A personality, but, he also was a, a very nurturing person too. He always wanted to make sure he took care of three kids. And so my childhood was, I would say, middle class. We weren't poor, but we didn't, we didn't have an unlimited amount of funds. So my dad worked a lot, he worked at all the opportunities that he had. And so when him and my mom were married, in their early years, my dad was kind of like me. He had that entrepreneurial spirit. So, he started his own little sharpening shop on the side when he was working in a factory. And he also, he bought some apartments, but then he realized really quick that my mom wasn't very good at managing money, and she was really dishonest about, his checking account. And so he ended up almost losing everything he owned. He lost his apartments to a sheriff's sale. He lost a lot, and he almost lost our house. But by the time that he finally threw in the towel on his marriage with my mom, he was able to recover a little bit and eventually end up keeping, you know, our house that that we grew up in. So it was tough, but at the same time, it taught me a lot of valuable lessons about the baseline or the foundation of life and how you overcome obstacles in life.
What was his name?
Howard Canfield.
And all right, so you went to public school?
Did I went to public school, Black River, which is in Sullivan, where I'm at now. And so I graduated in 93.
Now let's just talk a little bit about grade school and all typical. I mean, what were your favorite subjects, or were you into sports? What were your interests in school?
Yeah, I was really good at, you know, when I was a young kid, I was, and this is a crazy swing on my school, but when I was a kid, I had a very high IQ and I was kind of off the charts. You know, when I took my CAT test at the end of every year, my scores were always off the charts, but I was one of those kids that I did not like doing homework, and I just barely did enough to get by in school. And by the time I got into high school, Greg, I was told that I would not graduate. And I was in it was the 11th hour. I was a senior, and I was told by my high school principal that I would not graduate and that I might as well just quit and give up because I wasn't going to make it. And I converted that into fuel. And a long story short, I mean, I basically pulled it together and I was able to graduate with not just my high school diploma, but also a 2-year certificate in machining technology. So I got 2 diplomas when I graduated.
So what happened in high school? I mean, like, tell a little bit more about, you know, you're on the verge of not graduating. You know, it was touch and go there for a while. You pulled it off. They told you to quit. Like, what was going on with you?
So you know, this is a true story. It's kind of crazy because as I look back, I realize, you know, kind of all the paradigms of my life. But I remember being in 10th grade algebra, Greg, and I was not the most, I wasn't very studious. So I remember the teacher teaching us the mathematical formula for algebra, you know, the PEMDAS method. And I was confused but I got the right answer. I remember raising my hand in 10th grade algebra and asking the teacher to clarify something in my formula, and she would not answer me. Like, she just like totally ignored me and then went on to the next chapter. And so from that day, I lost all interest, and I literally, in a more defiant way, I put my head down on my desk, and I basically used my 10th grade algebra as my study hall or my period to just get some sleep, because I was very frustrated that the teacher would not acknowledge me and help me understand how I got the same answer, but I did a different way.
Interesting. Well, what about your peers? I mean, were you a lonely kid? Were you a loner? Were you just tell me about your friendship situation.
Yeah, I had a lot of friends. I would say that the friends that I had probably was not the group that I should have been running with, considering my future and what I would have known my future to be. I wasn't a loner in school, but I just, you know, I had friends at school and they were kind of acquaintances. And that was about that. I mean, it was a social part of my life, but it wasn't the main part of my life. So,
tell me about your favorite subjects again, if you don't mind.
Yeah. My favorite subjects were, English. I loved spelling. I liked math all the way up to the 10th grade.
Yeah.
Those were probably my 3 favorite subjects.
So, and when did you start kind of thinking, okay, wait a second, the Marine Corps is out there? Like, when did you first become aware of the Marine Corps?
You know, it's funny, man, because I was in, I was at lunch with all my friends. We were all hanging out at this table. And I remember seeing the Marine Corps recruiter come through one day, and he walks into the room and he sets up his little table and all of his little Marine Corps brochures. And I just remember telling myself, because I was going through this epiphany in my life. Like, what am I going to do when I get out of school? Because I don't want to go to college and I don't want to really necessarily work in a factory all my life. I saw, you know, what that did to my dad. And so as soon as I saw this Marine Corps recruiter, it's almost like I had that major epiphany and I said, aha, this is it. You know, it was a big aha moment for me. I knew that, you know what, that's what I want to do. I want to go in the Marine Corps and I want to become a United States Marine.
Tell me a little bit about like what you observed more, if you can go into a bit more detail, like the epiphany, what, just go over that again. And again, like, what was it about? Just tell me more about why,
you know,
the Marines appeal to you.
Yeah. Yeah. So I knew that at that time I was in a relationship with a girl. I knew that I couldn't see a future with this girl. And then, you know, I'm in my senior year and I've been told that I'm not going to graduate, you know, so I've got that going against me, major amounts of anxiety going through my soul, because I know, man, I got to graduate. Like, I cannot disappoint my dad. I refused to let my dad down and disappoint my dad. So, you know, it was when I saw the Marine Corps recruiter, it was like all crossroads came to an intersection that day with me in my mind and my soul, because I knew that that was my answer. Like, going in the military was my answer. I didn't want to go in the Army. I didn't want to go in the Navy. I wanted to go in the United States Marine Corps, because they, like, I saw the movie Heartbreak Ridge as a kid, and I knew that that was like the coolest thing. You know, Clint Eastwood made it look so, you know, realistic and so high speed, low drag. And so I realized that, man, that's my college. The Marine Corps is my way out of here, because I'm not really, I'm working at a dead end job. My relationship isn't, you know, anything that I can see coming to fruition in the future. You know, the girl that I was with, just, I mean, her and I are still friends to this day, but it's just not a road I wanted to go down. It wasn't the right road, I'll just say that. And I just knew that college was not an option for me. I wasn't interested in my life at that point to go to college.
What do you remember about the recruiter himself?
I remember the recruiter, Greg, quite frankly, like it was yesterday. He was very stoic. He was the epitome of a Marine. He had the look of a Marine, tall, slender, you know, built dude, you know, very, he looked the part. You know, he wasn't a dorky, drabby kind of guy. You know, he looked very stoic.
Was he in dress blues, or do you remember any of that?
Dress blues. Yes, sir.
Did he come to the, and tell me again, was he at the high school? How did you encounter him?
He was at the JVS. And at this point, like, I'm going through it in my soul, because my principal basically said I wasn't going to make it. So I had all of these storms of doubt going on in my soul. Like, man, I got to graduate. If I don't graduate, I'm going to be a failure all my life. And I don't want to go to college. And right now I don't have the grades to go to college. I can't even be accepted into a community college because my grades were just really poor at that point. So I just remember when he came in, he was in his dress blues. And I could remember the reaction of most of the kids that were there. Like, you know, they all really looked up to this guy. And I was in my senior year. So it was at the lunch. You know, we were at lunch when the recruiter came in. You know, he took the lunch period to come in and talk to the young kids. You know, what are you going to do? You know, what's your future look like? Have you ever thought about going in the Marine Corps or the military? You know, so I remember when I saw him, I was just like, you know, it was an immediate aha moment. Like, I know that this is what I want to do. Like, that's it. I got to figure it out. I got to figure out how can I get from here to there and, you know, graduate and go in the Marine Corps.
You mentioned the principal wasn't really, I mean, was he being realistic regarding you, or was he being overly negative? It didn't sound like the kind of pep talk I was expecting, or it wasn't really a pep talk at all. You know, you're kind of screwed here, pal. Right? It just sounded like,
yeah.
So looking back at that, at yeah. how he treated you, you know, was it being realistic? Was he giving you the motivation that you needed to hear? How do you feel about him now?
No, and it's funny, man, because our principal was a female. Her name, I won't say her name on the air, but it was a female. And she, for whatever reason, did not like me. I wasn't a kid that I didn't cause trouble. I never caused trouble in school. I never got in fights. You know, the only time I ever fought in school was to protect myself. But I never really got into fights in school. I wasn't really a majorly rebellious kid. But I just remember when she said that to me, I virtually lost all complete respect to this lady. Like, I don't respect this lady at all. Like, and I was out to prove her wrong. That was my number one goal and mission in life, was to prove her wrong that day.
Interesting. So she's still, do you know if she's still at the school or whatever happened to her?
Well, she wasn't. Yeah. I just know that she ended up going somewhere else. She was not very encouraging to kids. She wasn't there as support for the kids. She really, I mean, honestly, she was not, she was in the wrong job, position. I will just say that she really didn't, it's not like she gave kids pep talks or anything like that. She was kind of a mean lady, but I just remember, and I have to give her some credit, because had she not told me that, Greg, I would have just kind of floated through and I probably would have ended up failing. But because she told me, you know, I remember I was at the graduation practice, show up to practice for the day that we would all walk across the stage. And she said, Brent, I don't know why you're here. She said, you're not going to graduate. And I'm like, what do you mean I'm not going to graduate? She said, Brent, you don't have enough credits to graduate. You're failing and you're just not going to make it. So I honestly don't even see the point in you participating today. Why don't you just go back to the joint vocational school for the rest of the day? And I'm like, you know what? Forget it. I'm out of here. So I literally just left. And from then on, I just started skipping school a lot. I just lost all complete interest in school.
So, all right. But you know what you're doing. At this point, have you met the, I'm sorry, at this point, had you already met the recruiter?
No. At this point, I had not seen the recruiter yet. In fact, the recruiter, that was about the springtime. And I just remember the recruiter was about May, you know, about April, no, probably February, March. I remember seeing the recruiter probably around February, March. And this was just prior to that. So I guess it would have been a little prior to spring. It would have been in the wintertime when she told me this.
So this is in the early 90s. And by the way, back then, I think you have to be a high school graduate to join the Marines, or do you?
That's right. No, you gotta pass. You gotta graduate. And when I talked to the Marine Corps recruiter, he put me on the 6-month delayed entry program because he was anticipating I was going to graduate.
So, okay, how did you pull that off? How did you, like, the so 6 months? How do you actually get your degree?
I lived on no sleep. I went and talked to a lady who's not around anymore, but she was a career counselor at the JVS. She was basically a counselor for the joint vocational school I was going to. And she was the sweetest lady I ever met in my life. And she told me, she sat me down one day and she said, Brent, I'm looking in front of you and you have two roads in front of you. She said, I'm just going to say it just like this. If you want to graduate, if you want to make it, it's going to be because of your effort, no one else's. And she said, don't ask me for a free ride. Don't ask me to do it for you. You're going to have to earn it. Now, how bad do you want to be a Marine? And I said, I want to be a Marine and I want to graduate. She said, then this is day one. I want you to get started today. And so she helped me get the curriculum that I needed, Greg. And she worked with me before school, at lunchtime, after school. She counseled me and she had me enroll in correspondence classes to make up the credits that I was missing. And that lady was responsible for helping me graduate.
By the way, JVS, it's a junior vocational school. Is that what it stands for?
Joint vocational school.
Go ahead.
Yeah. It's a trade school for kids in their junior and senior years. In a lot of, schools throughout the Midwest that, give you realistic trade careers to become acquainted to before you graduate. So you'll spend your junior and senior year in the trade in which you want to, you know, that you think you want to be. But for me, I was in machine trades, but I just knew that that really wasn't my, it wasn't my, being a machinist wasn't my passion.
So that's run by the state, right? That's a state run program. The JVS.
It's a state ran, yeah, state ran program.
And yep. All right, so you buckle down, you make it happen, and was it a learning experience? I mean, did you find yourself? Wait a second, okay, I'm learning here, or is it I'm talking about the material itself. Did you expand? Did your brain expand, or was it just, you know, cramming to get through the test?
Yeah, no, it, you know, to be honest, I learned a lot, but I crammed a lot. And I would say that I didn't really retain the information as I was doing it. But I'm one of those people that as I absorb information, it comes to me at a later time and it makes sense at a later time. But it was very resourceful and it helped me learn from a different angle. So the subjects that I was learning in my correspondence classes helped me to understand and develop my mind with those subjects in a different way, if that makes any sense.
No, it does. It does. All right. So is it a great day when you graduate, or do you just get a letter in the mail, or how do you find out you're done, you're finished?
So this is the coolest part of the story, man. So I didn't know if I graduated. I was pins and needles. Graduation day had passed. I never walked with my class. My dad was wondering, you know, like, why aren't you going to graduation? I'm like, I'm just not going to go, Dad. Okay, fine, whatever. My dad was never a micromanager. So graduation day passed. My Marine Corps recruiter, Staff Sergeant McDaniels, is the man who ended up bringing me both of my diplomas on a hot June morning. And he said, he knocks on my door. I answer the door. There he stands again, very stoic in his dress blues. He said, well, do you want the news? And I said, yes, sir. He said, I happen to hold in my hand two diplomas. He said, you graduated. Your test scores came back. He said, I got the release from your scores. He said, you passed. And I've got your diplomas. I made the schools both release your diplomas and gave him a high five. He took me on a little 3-mile run and I ended up puking my guts out because I was not in very good shape in that time. But it was my Marine Corps recruiter that brought me my diplomas, two of them.
Awesome. So two of them from JVS and from the high school. And you got it basically in time, right?
And I got it in time.
All right, so what happens next? You're in no shape to go to boot camp, but it's actually sometimes they just take you. And, you know, you get in shape when you're at boot camp. How long before you actually went to boot camp?
Yeah, so I was never really a fat body. I was never, that kind of out of shape. Like, I was always in good shape, but I was not in cardio shape. I had strength, but I did not have endurance. So I never really ran before in my life other than, you know, when I wrestled a little bit in high school. So I have a new challenge because now it's like, okay, I'm ready to go to the Marine Corps. I've qualified. They're going to get me in. I'm going to go. I've got a ship date now. Now I got to get myself in shape. So it was like literally like me eating the elephant one bite at a time. Like, how am I going to, okay, now I've graduated. Now what do I got to do? So now I had to go out and start running on my own. And so I would go out and run on my own. And I always had this mindset and I'll never forget this, Greg. The recruiter told me, he said, listen, Brent, you're going to get in there in the Marine Corps and you're going to have some people that are in great shape and they're going to run. He said, I only want you to do this one thing. Try to pass the man in front of you all the time. He said, when you're on a run, just make it a point to try to pass the person in front of you. And I did. That stuck with me. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to try that. And I did. And it helped me pass my IST. And I will say this. I never fell out of a run my entire career in the Marine Corps. Never fell out of a run, ever. Not even the first IST that we took when we got to boot camp. I refused to drop. I refused to fall out.
So, and boot camp is in Paris Island, right?
Paris Island, yes, sir.
Yelling and screaming, shouting, all that stuff. Did you like it? Did you regret it? Do you ever think, like, what the hell did I do this for?
I don't think anybody likes it, but I will say this, that all the years of, you know, growing up with my dad being very critical in my life and my dad being very demanding, boot camp was not a breeze for me. It was tough, like it is for everyone. But it was natural to me. I was used to that mentality, you know, get it done now. I got guys screaming in my face. You know, obviously my dad never screamed in my face, but my dad yelled at me several times. You know, for me, I was mentally and physically, I was, you know, really prepared for it, but mentally I was prepared for it because of my upbringing.
So after boot camp, and just give people a sense of what is it like overall? What are they doing to you? How do you describe boot camp?
So boot camp is an event that will challenge you to your very core. It challenges you mentally. It challenges you physically. At the very deepest, most inner part of your core. it's very physical, it's very intuitive, it's very strategic, and it's, they got you moving at all times, and it's a lot of mind games. You know, if you just if you let things get to you, like anxiety get to you, it will run like storms through your soul because you never know what's coming next. I mean, they tell you, you know, this is first phase, this is second phase, this is third phase. And in these phases, these are at the activities, and you have to pass, you have to make it, you have to shoot this kind of score, you have to run this kind of PFT. And so every day is a new challenge, and you have to shoot, you have to swim, you have to run, you have to do pull-ups. And so it's very demanding. It's not like, you know, I think, you know, I always said I was never the college type, but man, that's a whole different dimension. So boot camp is very demanding. It's very challenging. And it helps you, that the thing that I love the most about it, Greg, is it helped me find who it is I really was. No more BS, no more facade, no more lies, no more gimmicks. I literally had to do a face on face with myself in Parris Island, South Carolina. And I had to learn precisely who it is I really was.
Wow. Well, awesome. That sounds like you had the ultimate experience. What graduation day comes and they tell you your job. I mean, that's how it seems in the movies. What do you do next? What is your job? What do they tell you you're going to do?
So I was open contract, which adds another faucet of confusion to the whole thing. I was open contract because my ASVAB score wasn't very high. You know, I passed high enough on the ASVAB score to qualify. So I ship. So I graduate on January 21st, 1994. And I ship from Parris Island, go home on my 10 days of boot leave, my boot camp leave. And I come back and they ship me over to Camp Guard until they can figure out what MOS I'm going to be in. And so I go to Camp Guard and I end up getting into a fight with a couple of guys, because there was, I didn't realize this, but in Camp Guard, I was in Camp Guard with a couple of dudes, and they tried to torment a couple of the other Marines in my platoon. And so I just wasn't the kind of guy that got intimidated very easily. So I remember getting into a fight with one of them one night, and they broke it up. And they, you know, after we told both sides of the story, I remember the SOG, the Sergeant of the Guard, shipped the guy that I got into a fight off the very next morning. They shipped him off to SOI, which is, as you know, School of Infantry. And my MOS came down and I got to be a combat engineer. So I'm not saying that fight was what delineated what my MOS was going to be, but when the Sergeant of the Guard realized that I was only defending myself and another guy from being tormented from these guys, they basically stuck up for me. And you know, from there on, it was like I had a good rapport with that command. So they, you know, a couple of weeks later, they came down and said I had orders. And I said, you know, because I always regret it, Greg, and you probably know what I'm talking about. But I'm like, man, Lord, please don't make me a grunt or a cook. I don't want to be in the infantry because I've heard all the grueling stories and I don't want to be a cook. Like, that's not what I want to do. That's not what I signed up to do. So so the command came down and they said, we have orders. You're going to Courthouse Bay, North Carolina, which is just a few miles away, and you're going to be a combat engineer, 1371. And so I thought, you know, I started doing some research and I'm asking around and everyone's like, man, that's pretty cool, because, you know, if you're going to be a combat engineer, you're going to be involved a lot in math, or you're going to be a construction engineer. And so when I shipped to my unit, I realized I was on the demolitions side. So I basically became a demolitions expert in, you know, the first part of my career.
Talk about demolitions. What does that entail? It's blowing things up. What does it mean?
Yeah. So generally speaking, it's blowing things up, Greg. That's what I thought. And then I got there and I realized that your shots, your demolition formulas have to be surgical. They have to be precise. And so you have to know a lot of math. And so I had to go back to the grindstone again, and I had to relearn math all over again. I had to learn algebra all over again. I had to learn how to do mathematical formulas, and I started teaching myself not really quantum physics, but basically trig and calculus. And I learned things like you know, shapes and dimensions, and I had to go through geometry and algebra all over again. And so I did my MCI, which is the Marine Corps Institute. It's basically the Marine Corps Online College. I did my Math for Marines MCI over and over and over again until I really understood and basically had to, you know, had to learn math because, you know, when you're a combat engineer, you know, there were shots that we had to do where we had to use C4, which is a plastic explosive, and we had to do slap charges where we slapped these charges on the door handle and we had to blow the door off the hinges without hurting or killing anyone inside that room. And that has to be a very precise shot. So your formula has to be right on the money.
All right. Very technical work. Interesting work. What happens next? What year are we in right now, by the way?
So this is 1994, 5, 6, 1997. You know, in 97, when I got out of the Marine Corps, I thought I wanted to get out. I got out and learned very quickly that the civilian life was not for me, that literally I really loved being a Marine. But I remember I got out for a very short period, and I remember being at this place where I'm on an assembly line. And I thought to myself, you know, I've already done really a lot in the Marine Corps. I've rappelled, I've been on helos, tracks, I've been in boats, I've been on boat teams, I did amphibious raids, I was on ships, but it's like there's so much more to life. So I had this, again, I've had epiphanies all my life. I had this epiphany that I wanted to be a Navy SEAL. So I went down and I talked to the Navy recruiter.
I'm sorry, this is after you got out, right?
Yeah, this is after I'm out of the Marine Corps.
And just real quick, before
that,
where were you based? Where were you for most of your time in the Marines?
So I was in Camp Pendleton, California. My engineer school I did in Courthouse Bay, North Carolina. And then I shipped from Courthouse Bay, North Carolina, Camp Geiger, basically, to Camp Pendleton, California. And Camp Pendleton is where I did, you know, two of my tours.
How did you like California, by the way?
I say that California is my second home all the time. I love California. I hated it when I got there because it was a major culture shock for me. But the more I became adapted to it, the more I came acclimated to California, Greg, the more I loved it.
What was the problem when you first got there? Culture shock. Like what didn't you like about it?
Oh, culture shock. I mean, the smog, you know, the smog's there every morning till about 10 o'clock, you know, they call it an overcast. The people were much different. The environment was way different. Like there's no such thing as really, you know, there's bars in California, but in California, they're more like clubs and dance clubs. It was nothing like the Midwest. There was no really trees there. It was all just beaches and sand and fast living. And I just, when I first got there, I really did not like it at all. It was a major culture shock to me.
You say the people were different. How are the people different?
People were different because they were just like more open about everything, more accepting about everything, about society and just everything. And they weren't like where I'm from, you wave at somebody, they wave back. In California, you wave at somebody, they look at you like you're demented. You know, they're not a very, I don't know. It's not, you don't get the feeling of a very cohesive type of environment.
Well, it started to grow on you. Something changed.
It changed. By the time I got out of the Marine Corps, my first tour, when I left for a short period, I got home and realized how much I really became adapted to California and how much I really loved it and missed it. Like, I loved the beaches. I loved knowing that I could go skiing and surfing all in the same day. And, like, you know, where I'm from, it just doesn't lend itself to that kind of, you know, lifestyle.
So, all right. Now, what was your initial obligation in the Marine Corps?
My first tour was 4 years. And so I did my first tour, you know, and I got out, I left the Marine Corps for a short period in 97.
Yep. So why did you get out? You're enjoying it. And like, why'd you leave?
I, you know, for me, it was like, I want to be free. You know, it's like in the Marine Corps, you know, it's structure. It's, you know, of course the discipline, and I never had a problem with discipline, but I wanted more freedom. I wanted to be able to come and go as I pleased. I wanted to be able to do whatever it is I wanted to do. I felt like I had the military thing behind me now. I'm 4 years beyond. And so I'm like, you know, I just want to go get into a career now. And so when I got out, I did everything but that. I was working at a factory, you know, on an assembly line. And you know, quite frankly, I just realized that really there's no, there's, I had a much better time in the Marine Corps because, I mean, think about it. I'm out in the desert, I'm blowing stuff up, I'm doing surgical shots. I'm on a, you know, one day I'm on a raider and I'm doing a raid, you know, from a, you know, from a ship, a 15 mile transit inland to a beach. I'm securing the beach. So I'm on an amphibious boat team. I was doing helo inserts, extracts. I was in counter drug operations. I mean, I did a lot of things in my first 4 years.
Where was the assembly line? What were you assembling?
We were assembling, pumps for Navistar, which was a contract that they had for Ford, you know, putting these hydraulic pumps in for diesel trucks. And so I built these hydraulic pumps, you know, one after another.
And
I just realized that, you know, that's not what I wanted to be doing.
How long did you do it? And tell me about the epiphany, or was it an epiphany? I got to go back in the Marines.
Yeah. So I did that for about a year. And then I realized, I just remember coming home one day and I told my dad, I'm like, Dad, this civilian life is just not for me. And my dad's like, well, what do you want to do? And I said, I think I want to be a SEAL. And my dad's like, you want to be a SEAL? And I said, yeah. And he said, okay, you know, whatever. And so I remember going to the recruiter's office, and it's funny too, man, because I'll back up a little bit. Before I had this conversation with my dad, I'm going to work one day and I go into this small convenience store and I'm buying, you know, like I'm buying like this hoagie sandwich and a Mountain Dew. And I'm in this line, and I remember looking up in front of me, and this dude in front of me looked really familiar. And he turns his head to the side, and I look, and it's my squad leader from Camp Pendleton. He's in Worcester, Ohio. I'm like, what the heck? And I bump him. I'm like, dude, what are you doing? And he's like, holy cow, Canfield, what are you doing? And so we start talking, and I'm like, what are you doing here? He said, dude, I just got my orders. He said, I got to do my B billet. I'm a recruiter here in town now. I'm like, holy cow. So we start chatting. He's like, dude, let's hook up later. So I did. And he's asking me all about being out of the Marine Corps because he had thought about getting out. And he's like, what's it like? And I'm like, dude, honestly, you don't want to be part of the civilian life. I'm like, it's not for us. I said, you know, it's like, I'm actually thinking about going in the Navy. He goes, really? And I said, yeah. And he goes, well, I happen to know the dude, you know, in the office next to me. He said, you should come in and talk to him. I said, okay. So a couple of days go by. So I go into the Navy recruiter's office and I sit down and I'm talking to this guy, and he's like, yeah, you tell him my background. He's like, what are you, crazy? I said, why do you want to be a SEAL? You're a Marine. I said, because I want to be a SEAL. You know, I've done a lot of things, you know, in my career, you know, in the Marine Corps. And I want to be a Navy SEAL now. Now this is 1999. And this guy's like, you know, I can get you a school seat for, you know, boot camp or whatever, and get you an opportunity for buds. He said, but I can't ship you until April. And I said, I don't want to go in April. This is like February. I said, I want to go now. He said, I can't get you in now. And I'm like, I want to go now. And he's like, I can't get you in. I said, well, then forget it. So I gave up my.
Can I ask? I mean, look, you know, these things sometimes take time. I mean, like, why was the, what was the rush? February, March, April, that's 8 weeks. Why couldn't you just, what was going on with you where you had to go right now? I mean, you had to join the SEALs right now. That was your attitude.
You know, it's funny, Greg, because I've been like that my whole life. It's just the way I've been wired. I like everything right now. Like I want to go. It's like when I decide I want to do something, it's like I want to do it right now. And so, but I was okay with going through the process, and I get that. But he's telling me my school seat wasn't going to be able to come up till April, right? And this is early February, and so. As I'm talking to him, I'm like, no, you know, I want to go now because.
And by the way, that was a school seat. That was a school seat for buds, actually.
Yeah,
they could actually get you into SEAL school.
SEAL, yeah, to be a SEAL in buds training in April. I would say that is my only regret in life. I have no regrets in life on anything I've ever done. That's probably my one and only regret. But I'll parlay that story into how things land. So. I give up. I tell the recruiter, forget it. You know, forget it. I'm just going to be honest. This Navy recruiter was not a Navy SEAL. So he didn't give a rip whether I went into the Navy SEALs or not. He didn't care. I should have realized that. I should have realized that this guy didn't care. And when I done my recon, when I did my research on this whole thing, I did not realize, but he would have gotten no credit for me as prior service. And that's my guess is that's probably why he didn't push me very hard of getting me a sooner school date, because I know that there was, that, I mean, their SEALs, I mean, there's BUDS trainings kicking off about every month, right? Every couple of weeks. So I should have been more patient and I should have just waited. But again, that's hindsight.
All right. So did you like go from that office, step back to your buddy, the Marine, and say, that's what happened next, right?
I did, man. I literally walked out of the Navy recruiter's office and I was pissed that day because I went to see him. We had an appointment and he wasn't there. And I talked to one of the female poolees and she's like, well, he took off and he's not going to be back till tomorrow morning. And I was ticked off. And so I'm like, forget it. I said, when he comes back in, tell him he blew it. And she goes, okay. So I just said, tell him Canfield was here and he blew it. Oh, so I literally walked out of his office.
You're a bit of a hothead at this point.
Oh yeah, man. I was mad because I wanted to be a Navy SEAL.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment. I mean, look, Navy SEALs, they're great, but I mean, I've held the view that their training, their screening is almost unreasonably difficult. And, you know, like maybe 6% of the population can handle that kind of exposure to cold water. And, you know, there's probably a real good chance that you might not have made it. And no fault of your own. I think they're looking for people who have that gene, that cold water gene, or who knows. But I will say this. I've worked with some SEALs, not all, but some, after they get out of that training. And the training is so hard and it's so demanding and so few make it that they have the attitude for the rest of their life that get the hell out of my way. Nobody can tell me anything. I think it all worked out to your benefit. And I think you do as well. But I wouldn't regret that. You know, I mean, the SEALs, a lot of it is what we've seen in the movies, and reality doesn't always match up to the movies.
That's right.
All right.
That's
so
right.
Keep going. So you tell him, right. I'm going to come out. He blew it. All right. What happened next?
So I walk into the Marine Corps recruiter's office and I tell Clemens, I said, Clemens, what's the likelihood of me getting sworn in and going back in the Corps? And he said, dude, I can do it this afternoon. He said, I'm actually going to Cleveland to the MEP station and I can literally take you up there and have you swear in. I said, right now. He goes, this afternoon. I said, really? He goes, let me make a couple phone calls. He said, and then I can get you out of here. You know, you're going to have to go downtown, you know, retake the ASVAB, all that, fine, whatever. And
retake the ASVAB?
Yeah, well, he told me that because the first time I went in the Corps when I took the ASVAB, I didn't get a very high score. And they look at that. So although I was prior service, I wanted to go down and retake my ASVAB because I could have qualified for a higher, you know, MOS. You know, because you're thinking this is 4 years later, right? 5 years later. So I wanted to go down and take the ASVAB. So they scheduled my ASVAB test. I went down and I swore in with Major Grabowski. Never forget that. I'm in a goatee. I swear in and, you know, they basically swear me in and they give me a ship date. And my ship date was like in first part of March.
Hey, by the way, wait a second. Major Grabowski, he's a pretty tall guy, right? Yep. Tall, thin guy?
Yeah, yeah, yep.
Almost looks a little bit Mediterranean. Good-looking guy, right?
Yeah, yep, that was him.
Yeah, I definitely crossed paths with a Major Grabowski. Interesting, because I was on active duty at this time. Anyway, keep going.
Yeah, so I sign back up. I go down, and I talk to my dad. I told my dad, I said, Dad, I just rejoined the Marine Corps. And, of course, my dad's like, you know, I thought you wanted to be a SEAL. I said, I did, but, you know, the guys can't get me, you know, until April, and I'm not waiting that long. I want to go now, you know. And so I remember that all part, you know, partaking. And so I get my ASVAB scores back, and I scored pretty high. And so I got to pick an MOS, and so I picked the communications field. So now I'm going back in the Marine Corps to be a field wireman. And it's crazy because I called my old battalion Sergeant Major Raybon, and I had a great, you know, I did very well in the Marine Corps. So I got promoted quickly. You know, I was on meritorious boards. You know, I did a lot of cool things. And so I called my old Sergeant Major, and this guy loved me. This guy had a lot of pull. And I said, Sergeant Major, I want to come back to our battalion. And he said, you want to come back to our battalion as a wireman? I said, yes, sir. He said, okay, I'll make it happen. So when you get down to main side, you know, you check in with First Mar Div and you're going to get another set of orders, and that second set of orders will bring you right back to, you know, First Combat Engineer Battalion. So that's where I went. I went to my wire school out in 29 Palms, California. And then when I graduated, I literally went right back to First Combat Engineer Battalion, but this time as a field wireman. And so now I'm a corporal, and I, right after I got to First Combat Engineer Battalion, I picked up sergeant. So I became a platoon sergeant.
Hey, do me a favor. What is a typical day like for a platoon sergeant? Number one, do you live out in town, or are you on base?
No, at this point, Greg, I'm on base, and I didn't really move out of town until I got married. I got married to a girl in the Marine Corps. Bad decision. We didn't have any kids or anything. It was a bad decision, and we ended up going through a divorce about a year later. It was a very short stint. But because I deployed all the time, I was gone all the time. And so, you know, I went through a divorce, and then after that, I moved back to the barracks from being on base. We lived in Onifray housing. I moved back to the base, and from there, I basically rededicated myself to my career in the Marine Corps, and I did a lot of cool things. And so,
well, hold on. When you're housing for a sergeant is kind of like a dormitory, right? It's like a college dorm.
Yeah, exactly.
So you get up in the morning. Just give people an idea. Like, are you? It varies, quite frankly, from unit to unit, tempo, ops tempo, that kind of thing. But what is a day in the life like for a Marine platoon sergeant?
So for a Marine platoon sergeant, you have to be ready before your Marines, and your Marines reveille usually is sounded at 5:30 in the morning. So you have to be there prior to 5:30 in the morning, getting your roster, you know, your morning roster ready. If you're doing training out in the field, you know, your gear ready, you got to make sure vehicles are pre-staged, got to make sure all your squad leaders are ready to go, that they're up before their Marines. And so my day would usually start about, I'd rise at about 03:30, 04 every morning, and I would be on deck by 04:45, 05, getting things ready. We ran pretty much every day. We'd run 7, 8, 10 miles. So I made sure that I was there, you know, doing my morning routine of stretching, you know, before we got the Marines out in formation. So we would sound reveille at 05:30 for the Marines. They would usually be out in formation by 6 o'clock, 6:15 in the morning. And then we would go for a, you know, a nice long, you know, morning run. So come back from the run, you know, we shower up, we change over, get into our uniforms, and we're in formation. On mornings that we ran, we wouldn't be in formation till probably 7:30. And then we kick the day off, and we would secure at 16:30 every day, 4:30 for civilians. We would end the day at about 4:30 in the day, you know, and then go out in town. That's what we call libo. You know, we're secured for liberty. You go out in town, get your hair cut, you know, get your uniforms out of the cleaners, or you go out and, you know, hang out with your buddies, have a beer, you know, get some dinner somewhere. But the op tempo was just continuous. So as a platoon sergeant, you know, you're usually there 4:45 in the morning, and you're usually not leaving until 5:30, 6 o'clock at night, because you're staying behind to get reports ready, you know, make sure all your Marines' medical and dental records are up to date, training, getting vehicles pre-staged and ready to go to the field. So usually you're averaging 80 to 100 hours a week as a platoon sergeant.
Sounds insane. That's a lot of work. But it's great. No, I know what it's like a little bit. All right. Now everything's going great. Where's your first major deployment? I mean, major, we're talking combat. Where do you go? What happens?
So, I transfer from First Combat Engineer Battalion down to Margarita to Comm Company. And Comm Company is on Main Side in Oceanside, California. It's just there past Main Side in Margarita. We call it Margaritaville, but Margarita, Camp Margarita. And so I transfer to a new unit, and I become the platoon sergeant for the wire platoon of a whole new unit. And when I got there, I'd been a sergeant for 3 years. You know, I'm a senior sergeant now. I'm I'm getting close to being in the zone for staff sergeant. So I decided to go to college at night. And my schedule just got flipped on its head, because now my schedule is 2 o'clock in the morning to study, to be up by 5:30 to wake the Marines up, get my squad leaders rolling, go on a 7, 8, 10 mile run, come back, go through my normal routine. And we were in the field a lot, Greg, prior going to Iraq. I'm at Comm Company now. Prior going to Iraq, I'll never forget when I was in the chow hall. I was, you know, we had been back from a run. I went and showered. I changed over, and it's about 6:30 in the morning. I just remember we went on an early morning run that morning, and we got back and I showered up. I changed over my uniform, and I'm in the barracks, and it's about 6:30 in the morning. It's about 6:15 in the morning. And I remember getting a phone call from another Marine sergeant friend of mine from his barracks room. And he said, "Bro, did you see what just happened?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Some planes just hit the towers in New York City." And I said, "Towers? What towers?" He said, "The World Trade Centers." I said, "No way." He goes, "Yeah." And he said, "Right now, the first one they said was, or no, I'm sorry, back up. This is when one of the first planes hit the tower." And he said, "And they're saying that they have possible suspicion of something going on." And then, so I tune in to the news station on the barracks TV, and I got to watch the whole thing unfold. And then as I'm watching this, I see another plane hit the second tower. And my first sergeant called down and said, "Hey, I want to let you know we're all on high alert." He said, "Because they suspect that this is terrorist activity." And so I remember being at the chow hall, you know, and went on to chow or whatever. I was at the chow hall, and I got the call to get back down to the battalion. And so that's when I'm in my new unit as a platoon sergeant. So, you know, it was weeks later when President Bush declared war against Iraq and literally launched that campaign.
What did it mean next for you guys? You're on high alert, and I guess everybody kind of gets spun up, but then things kind of die down. What happened next?
So, you know, prior to this, just prior to this, I was, you know, when I got to my new unit, my company commander, whom I'm friends with to this day, he put me in charge of these crew serve weapons competition at division schools because of all my training that I had throughout my career in the Marine Corps. And he gave me a lot of latitude. And so, long story short, my teams and I ended up competing against, you know, 1st Marine Division units on the infantry and non-infantry side for Hawaii, Camp Pendleton, and 29 Palms. And we ended up breaking all these records, and we took first place. So when President Bush declared war, they literally pulled me out of my wire platoon and asked me to be a platoon sergeant for security teams. And so now I'm basically, in retrospect, I'm a combat team platoon sergeant for RFQ elements, which are, you know, QRF teams, which are quick reactionary force teams.
All right. So means you're a tip of the spear kind of guy. You're going. Somehow you're going to be going to war soon.
That's right.
What happened
next?
Right.
So I formed my teams. We flew out from Pendleton into Bangor, Maine, Bangor, Maine to Frankfurt, Germany, and then Frankfurt, Germany into Kuwait. And within 2 weeks of us being on the ground in Kuwait, we were punched. We were going across the LOD, which is the line of defense. And I was setting my teams in place to protect convoys, foot mobile patrols, and basically bivouac, you know, security. So we were setting up, you know, 360s to secure the perimeter of headquarters battalion comm company.
And well, look, there's a bit of a delay though. 9/11 happens, and you know, this you're now poised to go into Iraq, right?
That's right.
So what happens in the interim between 9/11 and you go and you're staged in Kuwait? Was it just intense training? What happened?
It's intense training, Greg, and we were in the field every week. And so I said earlier I was going to college. I had to put my college on hold, but my schedule was insane because I was studying. I would get out of formation at 4:30. I would have to be in class by 6 o'clock. we typically did 4 hours of class. So I'd get out of class at 10 o'clock at night, which is 2200. I would get back to the barracks. It took me about 45 minutes to drive from Lake Forest down to Mainside. And I would study from, say, 11:30 at night to 2 o'clock in the morning. I would get 3 hours of sleep. I would wake back up at 05. I would hold formation at 5:30. And then we would be in the field every week, every week, every week. And so every night I had an arrangement to where I would leave the field at night after securing all the Marines. I would go to class. I would pack my books in and out of the field. And I did that for several months until we finally deployed.
Damn. that's pretty crazy. That is. Hey, by the way, are you saving money? Were you able to save money while you were in the Marines? How's the pay? How are your, you meeting all your needs?
Oh, man. Yeah, man. I would say that at that point, you know, we were getting, if we calculated our hourly rate, we were getting paid below poverty. So no, I wasn't, I never was a big saver. Not like I am now. I save a lot of money now, but in the Marine Corps, you know, I never had the latitude to really be able to save a lot of money. So I had a few thousand dollars to my name. That was about it.
All right. But you're loving life, or are you, is this, it just sounds so hellacious, but you're enjoying it. I mean, you wanted this life.
Yeah.
You left the civilian world for it. So you're, tell me about that.
Yeah. So at this point I would say that I'm at the epitome of my career. I'm at the pinnacle of my career, I should say. I love the Marine Corps. I had a very deep passion for the Marine Corps, my unit. I had a great rapport with my unit. My unit commander, my first sergeant. There's literally nothing I wouldn't do for my command, like literally. But I was a very demanding and a very critical leader in the Marine Corps. But I always made it a point, because I found Christ when I was in the Marine Corps, through a lot of things that, you know, I'd gone through while I was in. And so I always tried to treat Marines like human beings and not like numbers, not like robots. So I had all the Marines that worked for me wanted to work for me, and I had a great relationship with them, and it was the best point of my life. I mean, I'm at the pinnacle of my career, and then I received word in Iraq that I was in the zone to pick up staff sergeant. I was in the zone. I was going to be selected to pick up staff sergeant, and I had another epiphany in Baghdad in my sleeping bag. I remember waking up and deciding that I was going to get out of the Marine Corps entirely and going to go, you know, finish up my college. And then I was going to go into computer science and get a degree in computer science.
When you say epiphany, now at this point, you mentioned you have found Christ. Is this, do you think this is divine? Is this, how do you explain these epiphanies? Like, what is an epiphany in your mind? Is it God driven? Is it from God?
I think it's probably a little of both. I really believe that it was my life path, I think. And I believe it was God telling me that it was time to do something different, because apparently God's plan for my life and my plan or my path were not the same. Because when I went back in the Marine Corps the second time, Greg, I was there. It's like, okay, I'm here. I'm good. I'm going to make this a career. This is it. I'm not going to do anything different. When I was in Baghdad, I feel like we conquered the hill, so to speak. You know, we were in Baghdad. We took Iraq down. We pulled Saddam's statue down. But I had this epiphany, you know, crystal clear, that I want to get out of the Marine Corps. I want to finish my college, because I only had another module left to do before I graduated. And I wanted to get my computer science degree and be a network engineer. And so I remember breaking the news to my company commander, who had been one of my mentors. This man was, he went up from the rank of private to gunnery sergeant. Gunnery sergeant got commissioned, was a chief warrant officer, all the way up to chief warrant officer 4. And then he became commissioned as an officer, and he retired after 32 and a half years as a major in the Marine Corps. And he said, you know, Canfield, I get it. I understand. I'm a little bit heartbroken. He said, I think the Marine Corps is going to lose a really good Marine today. He said, but I understand. He said, you know, you've got higher sights on life. And he said, you know, I really encourage you to do what it is you're being called to do. So that's what I did. So I got out again this time, you know, I was in college and I finished up my college and got out, and I came home and worked as an IT consultant. And then shortly after that, I took a position with a law firm called Jones Day.
Okay, wait, hold on. I just got to jump in for a second. You got a few more minutes, right?
Yeah.
All right, so do me a favor. Regarding Iraq, just tell somebody, what was the biggest surprise, or what would somebody be surprised about your experience? Something that was just, you know, unusual or different, or you didn't see coming about Iraq?
So I would say that Iraq was an experience. We were amped up, you know, as Marines. You know, it's like, you know, we always say that when they call the Marines, then that means by then negotiations are over with. Like, there's no more negotiations because they're sending the Marines. We ran very hard and fast. It was very demanding. I got into a very serious accident in Iraq. We were running so hard one night, we ended up running into the back of a, what we call a communications van, a 42 van. And I jacked myself up pretty good, but I kept going. And so I put all my Marines on a truck and got them out of there. And I stayed back with one other sergeant and secured the comms vehicle. Tore myself up really bad. I was bleeding out like a stuck pig because I basically about halfway went through the windshield of this crash that we were in and destroyed this Humvee. But I would say that all the riffraff that people heard back in the States about there not being weapons of mass destruction and Saddam was really a good guy and all that was all a bunch of crap. Because this guy not only had his hands on weapons of mass destruction, but he planned on imploding Baghdad because he knew the United States was going to come in and were going to rip him apart. He knew that. And he was literally going to turn on his own guys and basically sacrifice his own military and send all these bombs in on Baghdad and just blow Baghdad and take Baghdad off the map. So he was not a very nice guy at all. He was a horrible person.
By the way, how long were you removed from duty? Were you removed from duty for that injury?
No, I was not removed from duty. I kept on going. Basically, I ended up sewing myself up because my arm kind of sort of went through the windshield of this Humvee, and I had to end up stitching myself up to, you know, stay in the fight. So I did that, and I had to change camis, obviously, because I bled all over my camis. My camis being a uniform, you know, we wear. Obviously, civilians don't really understand that. But, I just stayed in the fight, Greg, because I wasn't going to let that take me out. So there was no hiccup. There was no transition there. I just stayed in the fight.
Wow. Jim, and you know, it's interesting though, there are kind of weird random accidents that happen that people don't, appreciate, you know, this is dangerous stuff, not just engaging the enemy, just moving all this equipment all over the place and at night and lots of things can happen.
Yeah. War is real. War is hell.
Where did you go to college? What school was it?
So I went to Computer Education Institute, which then became Merritt College. And I got all my Microsoft certifications and I basically went the Microsoft route while I was in college. And so, but I finally graduated and I had one more module left to do. So when I got back from Iraq, I re-enrolled in school and I finished up my last module. You know, fresh. I'm actually still in the Marine Corps by that point, but I graduated like a week. My module ended about a week after I EAS'd out of the Marine Corps. And so I remember everybody in the college asking me, you know, how was Iraq? You know, what's this war like? And, you know, and I'm like, look, man, I'm just glad to be home. You know, I'm just going to say that.
So, by the way, Merritt College, is that what it's called? Where is it?
Yeah. Merritt College out in Lake Forest, California.
And why computers? I mean, nowhere in our conversation have you mentioned any kind of fondness for tech, as I can recall. Like, was that something you new to, or just something you tell me about that?
Yeah. So it was intriguing to me, Greg, because at that point, that was the infancy stages of Microsoft. It's when Microsoft was blowing up and, you know, we were talking about Active Directory and group policy objects and databases and units and users and domains, and all this stuff was very intriguing to me. I don't know why, but I just picked it up one day. I remember talking to another Marine. He's like, man, this Microsoft company is blowing up, and they've got this new thing now where they can control a network, and they have this network thing, and lots of people can be on the same wire and transpose information. It was really intriguing to me, because at this point I'm in the communications field in the Marine Corps, and I thought, man, this is great. You know, this is kind of new. At that point I still wasn't decided. I never realized I wanted to get out of the Marine Corps, but I just knew that I wanted to have college under my belt, and I wanted to graduate from a college.
You discovered you said you found Christ. When and how did that happen?
So I'm in Bridgeport, California, doing mountain warfare training. You know, it's cold weather training in the Marine Corps. And I remember my battalion chaplain pulled me aside one day and he said, hey, you ought to go to, service with us tonight. And I'm like, no, I said, I appreciate that, sir. But, I got stuff to do. I'm a platoon sergeant. I got a lot of things to do. And, I don't have time. And he's like, well, I'll just try it out. And I said, okay, fine. So I ended up going to the service one night, and I really liked it. I thought, this is kind of neat, because I knew who Christ was. But I just never, I was never a churchgoer, a lot in my life. So, but I remember that instance, and I was going through this, this divorce with the lady that I had married in the Marine Corps. And it was kind of a daunting time for me, because not only am I in college, but I'm going through this divorce, and I've got, my op tempo was very high. We're training to go to Iraq. And I lived on literally 2 to 3 hours of sleep a night. And so I had literally no life for myself. So, but I felt like this was it was a very peaceful experience for me, and it helped me find solitude a little bit. And so I ended up going down to Pendleton, and I got baptized in the Pacific Ocean one day, in service when I got back from our cold weather or mountain warfare training. And so it was very grounding for me. It was a way for me to, again, as I say a lot, I found the innermost part of my soul through that experience.
And how does it, two things, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
How do you practice, how does your Christianity affect you day to day? What and how do you carry on a Christian life? How would you say that?
I would say, you could handle it two ways. You could be very inward about it, or you could be very outward about it. And I think that's a great question, because it's not like the Marine Corps looked down on you for being religious or, having religion or found Christ, but there was always a mission to accomplish, and that was priority no matter what. So you, in a very weird kind of benign sort of way, you had to put Christ on the back burner, you can't go to service because you're in the field. So I was cool with that, because literally I knew that the Marine Corps was highest priority, in regard to training and, getting Marines ready to go. So it was an unusual experience for me.
And today, what is your faith like? Faith life like?
So today my faith life is, very active. Obviously I was at church today before this interview. That's very important to me. Faith is very important to me, because I know that we're all dying, and I know that there's another dimension, or another phase, as I call it, after this. I don't think this is the end all be all. So faith is very important to me, because I believe that the nucleus, the epicenter of faith, is Christ. It's just how I believe. I mean, whether it offends some people or not, I don't, I would say that I don't make apologies for my faith. But it's a center point for me, Greg. It brings me back to ground zero, as things in life try us all. We all have challenges, and everything I read in the Bible seems to parlay its way into life and teaching us how to live life, how to be kind to others, how to love others, how to forgive one another, how not to be this, I call it the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Even when Christ walked the earth, the Sadducees and the Pharisees were the religious people, and they thought they were better than everybody. And Christ was here to say that we're not better than everybody, that he sat with the sinners. And so I picked this up in the Bible, and I'm like, man, I can go for this because this is all about defying the odds, but being kinder to humanity. And everything I read in the Bible to me is truthful and it's inspirational and it helps me live a better version of myself.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. So much of what people assume religion or Christianity is about, it's just not about. You know, it's the opposite almost.
It's exactly the opposite. Yeah, that's a very good way to say it, Greg. You know, Christianity is the opposite of the gospel. I just say that. You know, I don't want to be a Christian. I always say I want to be a follower of Christ because Christians will lead you right to the ditch because they'll tell you why everyone else is wrong and not them and why everyone else is bad and not them. So I don't want to be a Christian. I want to be a follower of Christ.
Yeah. Yes. All right. I want to come back to that when we're done or on another time. I want to develop that with you. So look, you get your Microsoft certification. You've gotten you don't go right to the law firm. Where do you go next?
I went to a small company called Accurate Office Equipment, little mom and pop company. They serviced and maintained copiers for Canon. And they hired me to be the IT consultant to put these copiers on the network. And so that's what I did. You know, I went around and I supported this business and I was the IT, you know, director, manager, and I put copiers on networks and would troubleshoot them when they couldn't connect. And I loved that job. I didn't make a lot of money doing that job, but I loved that job because it was a new venture every day. You know, it was nothing like the Marine Corps, but it was a new venture every day.
How long were you there?
I was there for a couple of years and then the business kind of sort of started falling apart. The brothers kind of separated. I quit there. I left there and went to work for an IT consultant firm. And then they landed me a full-time contract with Jones Day. And that's where I became a network engineer for Jones Day. And I was at Jones Day for probably about 7 years Jones Day.
Major law firm. Which office are you in?
I was in the Cleveland office, their headquarters office.
So, by the way, two things. What was your job there and how did the lawyers treat you?
I honestly never had very much interaction with the lawyers. The firm itself was the best job I ever had in my life besides the Marine Corps. They treated us very well. The benefits were great. The pay was great. The hours were great. I worked basically 4 days a week. And I, you know, they went through a major layoff in, I want to say 2012, early to mid 2013. And I saw the writing on the wall and they retained my position. I never got laid off, but they let three of our senior engineers go. And I was only one of four left. And so I could have chose to stay there. I'd still be there today. Probably I check in with them every now and then. It's a very thriving law firm. Jones Day is a global law firm. I mean, they're all over the world and they practice corporate law. I mean, they're corporate attorneys. So it was a very good job. I didn't have really interaction at all with lawyers. I really just supported the network or operations center. As an engineer, I would look at, you know, high level network outages and troubleshoot network outages that, application outages, device outages, whatever.
I ask you about this? So network outages, yeah. I mean, you were one of the IT guys. You kept the networks moving, email systems, all that stuff, right?
All that, yeah,
now,
all that, yep.
One thing about this that I've wondered about, and it's like, I guess this is all before the cloud. Somebody described it to me this, and I'm not a tech guy, but, you know, you have Thomas Edison created electricity, and there were basically power plants all over the place, and you had to like hook up to this one power plant. And it's almost like when it comes to IT, every building, every firm, every business has their own IT department. But
that's
later
right.
With electricity, they just, okay, they created a grid, and you could just tap into this massive grid. And that's, I'm describing this all as a layperson, but that's kind of the direction we've moved, and that's where we are right now. Like, you don't need all of these network guys and IT guys as much as he used to, but they still keep him around for some reason. Does any of that make sense?
It does. It does. You're right. You're going to plug in somewhere, whether it's on a physical layer or a virtual layer. Either you're going to connect to the network via an Ethernet cable, or you're going to connect to a network wirelessly over a wireless connection. And, you know, to be honest, you know, IT is a very demanding field. It's a very lucrative field. And if you're really good at what you do, you can go really far in this industry.
So why are they still kind of doing this? Is it the old-fashioned way? I mean, does Jones Day need that kind of massive IT team or a significant IT team? Like Google, Salesforce, to a lesser extent, well, I guess those are the two. They're kind of maintaining all this stuff for everybody, aren't they?
You know, you're right, Greg, and that's a super great question, man, because, you know, right now it's like before, you know, you connected to a network and the IT guy was an expense. He was not, you know, I say this a lot in business. In business, you have assets and liabilities, and something, you know, something is going to fall into either the asset category or the liability category. And so assets are things that make you money, but quite frankly, an IT guy or a network engineer costs you money. You can say, well, they make you money because they keep you on the network and keep you connected. That's right. But I think this whole world, and I think you would agree that this whole world is kind of evolving into a content-based world and not a substance-based world. It's all about content now. It's all about, you know, numbers and likes, and, you know, social media channels are not what they used to be. And so I don't know if IT is going to be what it used to be, because they're starting to push everything to the cloud now. And by the cloud, people like Amazon Web Services are going to dominate, because they're going to be able to host all of your data, your databases, your applications, all in the cloud, your documents. And so I think that the IT industry is somewhat dying on the vine in a way.
All right. So 7 years, you see the writing on the wall. What's your next move after Jones Day?
So I remember coming home and talking to my wife, and I said, I think, you know, I want to quit and start my own company, my own security company, because I've always had a passion for protecting people. And I realized after 7 years of Jones Day that I still have the Marine Corps mentality, and I just can't see myself retiring in a glass cubicle at 65, 66, 67 years old. And so I told my wife, I said, I want to start my own company. And, you know, my wife is very supportive. My wife and I are best friends. She said, hey, do what you want to do. You know, we'll figure it out. And so I resigned my position. I tendered my resignation, and I started my own company. And I converted my tactical background, Greg, to a technical aspect of security now, you know, because I have the tactical background. I know how to secure the perimeter. I know how to secure an area. I know how to kick in doors. I know how to blow stuff up. You know, I know how to breach and get into the embryo or the nucleus of an area, but now I want to do it from a technical aspect.
Okay. There are a million things you got to do that you didn't know how to do, I'm guessing, in starting up a business. I mean, like all the legal stuff that goes with it, the administrative stuff, the accounting stuff. Is that a real struggle, or is it, it's a struggle like anything else. Just tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah. You know, I wish somebody would have told me when I decided to do this, Greg, what I was up against, because I had no idea that I literally was jumping into, you know, a situation very similar to Afghanistan and Iraq. You know, you're hopping into a hot zone. You're jumping into the pool feet first. It's been an experience, and it was, you know, I feel like the first 5-6 years of my business, it was a bloodbath. It was survival of the fittest, because you cannot run out of cash. You got to keep employees, you've got to get customers. I mean, it's a daily fight both directions. And I just know that my faith got me through every aspect of that.
No regrets? Did you ever regret it? No. Well, you just told me your faith got you through it. So you didn't look back.
I know I questioned myself, Greg, but I never regretted my decision. But I do remember several times questioning my decision. And I remember my dad telling me, are you sure you want to quit your job at Jones Day and start your own business? You realize what you're up against. I said, yeah, Dad, I know. You know, I just can't work for them forever. You know, I can't see myself there at 65, 67 years old in a glass cubicle. And dad, you know, dad said, all right, I'm letting you know that I really think you need to reconsider. My dad really was, he was kind of sort of against my decision. He said, I really think you need to rethink this, buddy, because, you know, it's not going to be as easy as you think it is.
Do you have a coach, or did you get a coach, a mentor, somebody to kind of guide you through all this stuff?
I didn't have a coach. I didn't know what an advisory board member was, but I remember early on in my, you know, in my startup stage, I remember a guy coming to me and telling me, he said, you know, you really need to form an advisory board and ask them to be on your board. And that's your, basically your steering committee. And I did that. I really did. I did that. And I would take mentorship from other business owners that were successful. You know, I wouldn't obviously listen to somebody who was only in business for a week, but I had mentors on my team, excuse me, on my advisory board committee that were seasoned business owners and into their millions. I mean, they were already making millions of dollars. So that's who my mentors were.
You know, it's incredible. You get a sense of what it takes to, it's one thing to work for somebody, but another thing to have people work for you. It is a monumental leap that, quite frankly, very few people can make. And, you know, just about, look, we all know what it's like to have a job, but very few people know what it's like to do what you're doing, comparatively speaking. You know, running the whole show. It's all on you. That's pretty wild. That's pretty wild.
Yeah.
All right. So, look, what haven't we covered about your business right now? What, first of all, what's the office setup like? Do you, are you working remotely? Do you have a headquarters? What's it all about?
Yes, we have a headquarters office in Ashland, Ohio, and we're expanding throughout the United States right now with a product that I called Sentry Pods. And that really, the biggest point of, I guess the one thing we haven't talked about is, because of my background as a Marine, because of my network engineer experience, I created an autonomous surveillance product after the Boston Marathon bombing. It flipped an internal switch for me, Greg. And so I designed an autonomous camera system that was redundant, and it had failover capabilities to the network and the power. And then I knew, you know, Marines like to talk in acronyms. So I called this product Sentry Pods, Protective Overt Deployable Surveillance. And my design philosophy behind my Sentry Pods is they have to be installed and accessible within 3 to 5 minutes. And so I quickly went to work on my Sentry Pods on designing, and, you know, my first iteration of a Sentry Pods camera system was a car battery, a power supply, a camera, and an internal router out in my parking lot. And I remember connecting to this thing inside of my building, and it wasn't plugged into anything. I was literally living on this car battery. You know, the power was subsequent to this power, this car battery. I had another aha moment because I realized that I just created something wonderful, because now I can give people portable surveillance. And so that was in right after the Boston Marathon bombing in 2013, right after I started my company. So it was literally probably, the Boston Marathon bombing. Yeah. 13. I think it was, 13.
Well, wait, what was it about the Boston Marathon bombing? Like, what, I remember it, you know, there was an explosion, the Tsarnaev brothers. I guess a lot of it was caught on tape, and we have, you know, the Ring of Steel you hear about in London. You know, you've got these cameras. They've been around for a while, too. Cameras that, you know, you go outside, there's a damn good chance you're being photographed, because there are security cameras all over the place. So two things. What is this? And we've had terror attacks throughout the country. What was the significance of the Boston Marathon? Let's just keep it on that one. What was the significance of that? Why was that one so significant for you?
That was significant for me, Greg, because we didn't know where they came from. We didn't know where they went. There was a massive manhunt for them. By the time they collected evidence, it was outdated information. Then they found the dude in the back of the boat. I remember that. They pulled him out of the boat, you know. I think the other guy got shot in crossfire between some cops. But the thing that hit home with me was, why are we always getting punched in the mouth? How is this able to happen? How are people able to get into our nucleus and punch us in the mouth? Who's securing the perimeter? So I created this product called Sentry Pods because I wanted to have portable surveillance that public safety officials and law enforcement could use to secure an area without having to physically be there. And there's a lot of faucets to the Sentry Pods. Like I can put up a Sentry Pods right now, have access within 3 minutes, and not ever physically have to touch that camera system again, because I manage it remotely. I pull the video down remotely from any internet connection I have in the world. I can connect to that camera, download the video remotely. I can send notifications to a central station operator remotely. I don't ever have to physically be there again unless I'm moving it.
And it's, so it's powered remotely as well. Like how is
it powered? Yeah. So typically it's plugged into AC power, but we do have units that plug into a solar controller array that we build. We started building our own solar trailers. So then we made them completely autonomous. I can park a unit out in the middle of a cornfield indefinitely, giving it power and accessibility to the LTE network or the 5G network.
And how is this different? What were the kind of cameras that we had in 2013 at the Boston Marathon bombing? Like how are these different?
Yeah. So I went to an FBI National Academy meeting and I talked to the guys that were in charge of that investigation, and they were talking about, they had over 2 terabytes of video from people that were capturing video that day or had taken video that day and had evidence of some things that happened. And they were getting video from the local mom and pop shops and the department stores and the coffee shops, the Starbucks. You know, before they had put this investigation together, they had over 2 terabytes of video content that they had to sift through. And then I, you know, even at that point, I thought to myself, but if we had our own camera platform that we could travel with, this wouldn't even be a thing. We could have captured this all within moments and had the evidence that we needed, because we had our own, we possessed our own ownership of this camera platform. And so that's when I, you know, that's, you know, prior to that's when I created the Sentry Pods product.
How much are they? Where can you buy them?
You know, you can buy the units, but typically we rent the units to lots of different industries. The units themselves are probably about $15,000 a piece. So they're not very cost effective, and it's not a consumer type product. It's more of an industrial, commercial, ruggedized product for military, Department of Defense, public safety, critical infrastructure, heavy construction. I mean, we have many industries, and they're spread throughout the United States.
You mentioned that you don't like going door to door, but sales is sales. Even if you're going to talk to, may not be talking to, you know, the Smith family, you're talking to a corporation. How much of your job is sales?
I mean, I say every day I'm selling, Greg, but I've focused my sales efforts into marketing strategies that are algorithms. It's all based on metrics. It's all based on content. It's all based on, you know, getting in front of people through social marketing, you know, social media marketing. And so that's really how I've grown my exposure and not had to do the door-to-door sales. I've just been very technical about it.
What's the next step? How do we, you're at a great level right now. I assume that there are other levels you want to achieve, get to. How do you do it? What's on the horizon?
So I would say a couple of things. One, I feel like I'm at the pinnacle of life. I'm having a great time. My business is growing. It's harvest season. I feel like, you know, in the Bible, you know, there's a time for sowing your seeds and there's a time for harvest. And I believe this is my harvest season. We're growing rapidly. All of our units are pre-configured, which takes the painstaking part of configuration away from the user. And when they receive their Sentry Pods, they can power them up, install them, and access them within 3 to 5 minutes. My dad, before my dad passed away in 2019, my dad helped me design the RAS attachment system. It's a rapid attachment system that allows me to install the Sentry Pods and lock it onto a surface, no matter whether it's a pole, a building, a fence, a block wall. I can install this plate and my Sentry Pods will install and attach to that plate within 30 seconds. So before I lost my dad, he helped me design the RAS system. And so that's been very close to my heart, that whole application of installing these very quickly. I say they're fast movers. They're virtual fast movers. I can put a Sentry Pods up and give you visibility to an intersection within 30 seconds. So we are renting these as a service, a surveillance as a service. to industries all around the country right now. They're pre-configured, and the moment they power up, my back-end services support team will stand the unit up, configure the notifications with your email address that you have, send you notifications based on the events of this, and also connect it to live central station operators around the country. And you have this service, and when you move, that Sentry Pods moves with you and goes to the next location. And basically, it's like rolling the sidewalks up. There's no pulling wires down, disconnecting cameras, taking the DVR out, unhitching the hard drive, none of that. You don't have to do any of that. It's all self-contained within our Sentry Pods product.
You keep this up. Go ahead.
Yeah, and it's wrapped into a service. I was just going to say it's wrapped into a service. So now it's subscription-based, and we're literally just going bonkers right now.
Is the government, I'm not talking about your customers. I don't know if you have government customers, but the government, what role do they play in the life of a businessman like yourself? Are they a hindrance? Are they a friend? Are they, good at some things, bad at others? How would you describe them? And I know there are lots of layers to the government, but just overall.
Yeah. I would say this, Greg. I'm a very no-nonsense type of person. I'm very transparent. I would say that, there's aspects of the government that's very beneficial to small businesses. There are programs that are aligned to small businesses, set aside programs in government for military or veteran-based businesses. But the red tape that you got to get through to get there, the layers you've got to go through to get there, is insane. It sucks. And if the government could just cut out all the red tape and improve these programs, I've always had ideas and ways to do it, but there needs to be a lot more support for the small entrepreneur, the small businessman, because we all know that entrepreneurs are what carries this country. Small businesses are what carries this country. There really needs to be a better way, and they need to reduce those layers and cut a lot of the red tape out, because it just prohibits you from accelerating, and it's a very slow, grueling process. But overall, the programs are there's a lot of great programs out there that have grants and set asides to help people, but they just need to do a better way with a better job of the process.
Yeah, a while back I was looking at this website. I just happened upon it, and it was for, if you're falling behind on your rent during COVID, you can get relief here. And I was fine with my rent. It wasn't me. I was working, but I was looking at this thing, and it was incredibly complicated. And I thought, if you can navigate this and actually contact the government and get them to pay you your rent, you've got the skill to buy the building that you're falling behind in the rent. I mean, it took so much. I could not imagine anybody actually pulling it off. And I guess that kind of reminded me of what you were just talking about.
You're absolutely right. That is very accurate. That's very accurate.
So these Sentry Pods sound like they could change the world.
It is changing my world by the day. I would just say that.
I got one other thing. What is your daily routine like? And do you have any special morning rituals? And what do you do these days for fitness?
So right now I'm still on the mend. I finally got my injury that I received in the Marine Corps. I finally got it worked on. Long story short, a couple of years ago, right before I lost my dad, I was involved in an accident. A drunk driver hit us coming back from a pilot program we put on for the Border Patrol, and he jacked my right ankle up all over again. And so I just have been recovering. I got a surgery last year in March, and I got some hardware in my ankle, and I'm hoping to recover here by spring so I can start training for my first ultra. But my morning routine is I wake up in between 3:30, 4 in the morning, and I go into my office and I work. I put in a day, and I usually get home between 5 and 6 in the evening. And usually my ritual is I'm a numbers guy. I'm a data guy, so I'm always looking at data and numbers in my business. And I create myself incremental goals on numbers I want to hit. And so I'm always studying that. I'm studying the project scope, projects that we're currently involved in, CenturyPods orders, on shipping CenturyPods, which ones are going where. You know, we're currently using these on the Marine Corps base in 29 Palms to secure some of the ranges and some of the training areas. And so I've always got a tethered line to the contract holder of that contract. And so I would say that my daily routine usually right now is meditation, Bible reading, you know, but when my ankle heals, it's going to convert over to my normal, you know, daily 6, 8, 10 mile run. I usually run between 6 and 8 miles a morning.
What? Wow. What? All right. Wait, 3:30 to 4 o'clock, you're getting to the office. Now, I mean, there's one problem there. It's that, you know, there aren't that many people to deal with, to call, to work with. I mean, or though, do you just need that hour, those hours for solitude?
That's why I do it.
Yeah.
Because Greg, when people start coming into the office, it's like the wild, wild west. I get pulled in 5 million different directions. So the only time I have to myself to get my tasks accomplished is at 3:30 in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning.
What time do you go to bed?
Usually I go to bed. I try to be bed by 9, 10 o'clock in the evening. You know, I try to spend, you know, a majority of my time when I'm home with my kids and my wife. We have dinner, we talk, you know, my rule is no phone, no device at the table. That's exclusive time with my kids, and not even the President of the United States can get through to me at that time.
How many kids do you have?
I have 3 kids, 11, 9, and 7.
Wow. And I'm sorry, we talked more about your first wife than this wife. Could you tell us a little bit about her, please?
Yeah. My wife, Shannon, is my best friend. I met her when I was still kind of sort of in the I joined the Marine Corps Reserves when I got out, so I was still kind of attached to the Marine Corps till 2008. But I met my wife. She actually was one of the girls that cut my hair at a place that she worked, and we just started talking one day, and I asked her out, and you know, she agreed to go out with me, and it's been history from there. Wow. So I have 3 wonderful kids now, and we've been married for more than 14 years, and I now know why God put me on the path that I'm on. That's the thing that I figured out is I wouldn't have landed here had I decided to stay in the Marine Corps when I was in Baghdad.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I love it. It's good for you and congratulations. You just got it all going on. And
thank you.
I'm very impressed. Is there anything else we should talk about that we haven't talked about?
I think through all of my experiences, Greg, I would say that I'm just one of those guys that, you know, when I go into a room, you know, I go very aggressively. You know, I still live very much like I'm a Marine, like I'm in the Marine Corps, I should say. You know, we're always a Marine, but I like to kick the door through and rip the door off the hinges. I like to rip the lid off the ceiling, if you will, because I just believe that we only got one shot at this life. You know, this is our only one and only shot, and I just want to make a mark and I want to make an impact for people. And so that's my philosophy. My philosophy is to go in hard. You know, don't crack the door open. Don't peek inside. Rip the door, kick the door through, and go into the room like you own it. You know, I did that when I was a young PFC, when I was on my first meritorious board to get promoted to Lance Corporal. You know, my squad leader told me, said, when you come out, you know, my board review was a sergeant major that was in Vietnam. He said, when you come out, he said, I want you to slam the door like you own it. I said, I can't slam the door. That guy will come out and rip my head off. He said, trust me, slam the door like you own that place. And I did. And next thing you know, I'm getting promoted. But that's my philosophy, Greg, in life. You know, don't crack the door. Don't peek in. Kick the door through and go into the room like you own the place. You know, and I think that's what we need to do in our life. You know, no matter what we do in life, do it to the best of our ability and do it with conviction.
Many thanks to Brent. Continued success at Smart Digital with those CenturyPods. Very, very cool. Very inspiring. I like that approach to life. You know, walk in the room, no apologies, rip off the door. I don't know if I can pull that one off. I think that's the approach to just everything. Just no holds barred. With excellence, you know, why not? And quite frankly, after talking to him and kind of doing a little introspection, there are a few things in my life that I'm approaching half-assed, to be honest, and I want to fix that. I really do. So thank you, Brent. Thank you, Brent, for the inspiration. And we know where you get your inspiration, so good stuff, good stuff. Folks, I want to wish you all the best for the holidays, a Merry Christmas, a Happy Hanukkah, whatever faith you celebrate. And if you want the perfect gift, give your friends and loved ones the pleasure of waking up every morning to a savory micro-roasted cup of coffee that supports quality coffee farmers, America's special operations community, and our great country. Visit D'Espresso LeBear. D'Espresso LeBear. That's D'EspressoLiBer.com. It's a veteran-owned, family-run, small business whose brew tastes as good as it will make you feel. After all, freedom does not brew itself. Remember that. And Merry Christmas, everybody.